I am so excited for my honor students to be on Tannins and Tunes and tell you all the nerdy things that they have learned this year. So we're going to hear things about feminism in Chicago, the history of a Coors Line. We're going to look at shows like Jesus Christ Superstar and Be More Chill. And also, we're going to hear about lighting instruments and how they evolved over time, along with all sorts of other really, really fun presentations. This show is going to be a little bit different, but I hope that you enjoy it. Give us some feedback. Let us know how you like it. Put in those iTunes reviews. Remember, we're donating $1 towards Napa Fire Relief with every review that we have on iTunes. So if you're just listening in, make sure to listen to other episodes of Tannins and Tunes. Give us that rate and review and have fun.
Time while belting a Bordeaux, pairing the best wines and picking the next show. Here Broadway guests end up acting like loons. This you can find here on Tannins and Tunes. When Ben Bradley cries, when the fight dies, whether June's or moon, I simply turn to my favorite thing, and they are a
So, Claire, wearing your Tannins and Tunes
yes.
T-shirt, I love it. You talked today about child labor laws, so let's
I
hear about
did.
that.
So, my research was basically how children made it to Broadway and how child actors went from being overworked to having child actors today who have schedules and different labor laws and how all of that came into play. So basically, my research thesis was during the formative years of Broadway, children actors were introduced to the stage and since then continue to bring a new dynamic. However, this edition also comes with strict guidelines and schedules. So basically, I started off my presentation touching base on how children made it to Broadway. And I mentioned how in Shakespeare, we see hints of children in Henry V, Julius Caesar, Macbeth, but there are no roles for children in those. We do see a murder of a child in Macbeth, but it's still not a role for a child. So basically, during this time, children were apprentices for Shakespeare plays back then to basically hone in on their craft so that when they're adults, they're already experienced actors. However, then we get to Pizarro in Peru, and that's the first child actually being seen on stage, where the character of Rolla has a young child, and that's in 1849. So this is really far back, guys. And then we also get to see, basically, these laws don't come into later, and children were overworked starting in like the early 1800s, which is really, it's really shocking to hear some of these stories. Like, I covered the Marsh Troupe, which is not really necessarily a famous troupe, but it was one of the first children troupes in America, and we basically see this troupe of 20 to 30 children performing adult material. So they're seen as equals in society, not necessarily equals, but they're seen as adults. As soon as you can walk and talk, you're an adult. And these children were performing really intense scenes, and so much that they were getting great reactions out of audiences. So people were coming to their performances, but these kids in the Marsh Troupe, they were owned by the leader of the troupe, which was Robert Marsh, who found the troupe, and the kids did not get to see their families, their parents. There was a lot of lawsuits in it, a lot of court cases about it, especially about Louise and Alfred Marsh. Their last names are not Marsh. That's just because they belong to the troupe, and then it was disbanded in 1863 in the Pacific Tour, but even though it was disbanded, it left a huge impact in pop culture and Broadway today. Like, we see children in vaudeville and Kid Cabaret, the Mickey Mouse Club, you know, with Ryan Gosling, Justin Timberlake, great show, super cute. I used to love watching reruns of that. And then one of my favorite movies of all times is The Little Rascals. So you really see like all child cast there and groups. So that was very impactful. And then we see the first child roll in Uncle Tom's Cabin, and we see, like, George, Shelby, is it Eva or Ava?
Eva.
Topsy and Emmeline. Mm-hmm. And basically, these were first roles that were written for children. So we actually have children filling in these roles. And then I hit on Annie, the musical, one of my favorite musicals. It's so cute. If you ever get a chance to see it, even if it's not on Broadway in the future, you know, go see it. It's a great one, guys.
Lots of kids involved in that one.
Oh, so many kids. And so we see in 1977, Andrea McArdle, she's age 14 during this time, and she plays the star Annie. And it is just an amazing show. And then lastly, I talked about difficulties and advantages of children working on Broadway, and we hit on the class we interacted together, reading all the different child labor laws, and there's a lot, guys. You can go and research them. There's a lot that these kids have to do. You know, they have really strict schedules. They have meal periods, rest periods, because this is their job, but they also have to balance schoolwork and trying to have a normal childhood to the best possible. And then we get to the day-to-day life of a child actor on Broadway. And some of these cast members, these kids, they will work from 8 to 3 on schoolwork and then go to the night performances. Or during their breaks, they'll work on homework or tutoring in a one-room schoolhouse. And it's just, when you have a cast made up of all children, you really have to have people working on it who are super patient, who are understanding of their time restrictions, and you may only get them for a certain amount of hours, and then you can't have them back for the rest of the day. So producers and directors have to be very patient and understanding. And I actually hit on a old Tannins and Toons episode during mine. It was episode 21.
Yeah, with Kara Holler.
Yes. It's so great, guys. If you haven't seen that episode, I 10 out of 10 recommend. So entertaining. So entertaining. And basically, Kara Holler tells Jimmy and Jessica that during School of Rock, she had to basically work with these children who are 12 years old, mm-hmm. and they are insanely talented. They're like quadruple threats here because they're playing instruments too. So it's almost like you see they're professionals, but they are also still kids, and a lot of people forget that sometimes. So when they're on tour and they're doing their performances, you know, kids are going to get smashed fingers, she said. Kids are going to get sick. They're going to have little tantrums every once in a while. You just have to be patient because they are still kids. But they're very professional, and this is what they want, and they know what they're doing. And then finally, I wrapped up my presentation. Why should we continue to use children in Broadway productions? You know, if the kid really wants it and this is their passion, it is great that we have children in the Broadway industry. And Broadway trains these young actors at an early age and gives them a real experience so that when they're older, they're so much more marketable in the Broadway world, and they already have all that experience in the bag, and they are ready to give full-on performances. They know what they're doing. And then it also increases the marketing towards families, because if the kids want to go see these kids' shows, the parents are going to have to also buy tickets for themselves. And so you're getting much more revenue. And then no imagination can replace a young child role with an adult actor. You can argue, but I'm telling you, I think it's really weird if you're going to have a 30-year-old playing like a 6-year-old. It's just not going to work at all. Like, if you saw the Von Trapp, how do you pronounce that?
Yeah, Von Trapp.
Von Trapp. If they were all like a bunch of 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, I mean, 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds are super cool. I mean, my older siblings are that age. But, like, I would not want to see them playing a 6-year-old. Like, I just would not believe that. That's just not believable. So it's very important that we have kids in Broadway today, and we have just made such a 360 from the 1600s to now. And it's just really awesome. So I enjoyed researching this topic.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned during your presentation that you went on a deep dive into Playbill.
I did.
How was that?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, if you guys have any questions or anything about Broadway history, Playbill is the hub for that. You can go on to playbill.com and go under Vault in the menu, and you can go back all the way to the 1800s to see these, to see when shows premiered back in like 1850. It's
like
insane.
Down when it was still in the Bowery.
Oh yeah, and a lot of these records have been destroyed over time just because, you know, record keeping back then was just not as prevalent as it is today. Mm-hmm. And you can go back and really see like the first shows and really keep diving into history. And that's how I found that Pizarro in Peru was technically the first child we see on stage by doing a lot of research, because if you Google that, you're not going to get straight up answers. It's a puzzle for sure. So
definitely,
if you're looking for that missing puzzle piece, go to playbill.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a very ancient saying, but a true and honest thought, that if you become a teacher, by your pupils you'll be taught. As a teacher, I've been...
Okay, so we are now joined by Kylie, and she did a presentation on social media and Broadway. Isn't that right, Kylie?
Yes, that is right. Thank you so much for having me. I talked about how social media kind of... it has obviously changed the way we learn and communicate and entertain and live on a daily basis. But I looked at specifically how social media is affecting Broadway. And it's integrated itself directly onto the Broadway stage as a character. It's gained this really influential ability, and it's also even begun recently to act as a producer. Looking at Dear Evan Hansen, you can see a really good example of Broadway or social media getting its big break on the Broadway stage, because in Dear Evan Hansen, social media can actually be seen as a central character. And it makes sense because culture is traditionally reflected on Broadway, which we see a lot of looking back over the history of musical theater, and a lot of our culture now revolves around the internet and technology. So it's understandable that what's being seen on the Broadway stage is social media, because that's what's being seen in our lives currently. The presence of social media in Dear Evan Hansen is really indispensable because it's a main character, so you can't talk about Dear Evan Hansen without talking about the main characters. Social media almost even has its own character arc, because you see the good side of social media and then the bad side of social media, opposite order, but still, it's kind of this unbiased representation where there's impartiality and there's room left for the audience to be reflective of social media as a main character in our own lives, because we see Evan and his relationship with social media, and we can be reflective of our own relationship with social media. Moving forward, it's likely to assume that we'll see more of social media on stage, because there's so many options and so much variety that creatives are given the liberty to make new stories about something that's super relevant to today. And then social media also has really strong influence in Broadway. Looking at the show The Great Comet, which went through a pretty big controversy with replacing or planning to replace a black actor with a white actor, and kind of as a result of that having a really big backlash on social media, which caused one of the actors to drop out of the musical, and then ticket sales struggled after that, and the show ended up closing. And it kind of just goes to show, it's not to say that social media caused the show to close, but it definitely was a major blow for the musical, because social media created this hostile environment that kind of made it really hard for the musical to find success after that. So it really makes you think what social media is currently capable of and what it could become capable of in the future, because driving away a really big star because of social media backlash, it's definitely something that we should, or it makes us want to be aware of how social media can impact us, and it's really crucial that we stay knowledgeable about what's going on with social media and how much of our opinions and preferences are being influenced by that. And also, social media can kind of act as a producer for Broadway. Looking at the musical Be More Chill, it really goes to show how much strength and influence social media can really have in this day and age, especially when it comes to money and making money and producing shows. It opened in New Jersey in 2015, but fizzled out and then for no apparent reason, it kind of started to resurface on social media 2 years later. So even though it was a show that the creators had kind of given up on, it started gaining a really significant amount of buzz on social media like Twitter and YouTube and Tumblr and Reddit, and it was creating like an entire fan base where people would make art and make animated shorts to go along with the music, and the streaming numbers were climbing. So kind of this sudden popularity on social media is what made it get recognized by a producer who actually went ahead to agree to produce the show on Broadway. So, given that the show is, like, youth-oriented, it makes sense that social media would have this kind of impact, because the audience who's relating with the characters is also sharing the show on social media and kind of promoting it that way. And the fact that it's having success on social media allows it to have success with producers, because they see that the show has potential because of the big fan base that it has, and they are more likely to agree to produce the show and more likely to have an easier time actually raising the money to produce the show. So it just goes to show that our capacity to share ideas and communicate opinions and participate in communities and social media is allowing social media to actually become a character and an influencer and a producer on Broadway.
That's awesome, Kylie. So in researching for this presentation, did you listen to Be More Chill?
I did listen to Be More Chill. I actually had heard a little bit of it before I started my research, but then I would listen to it while I was doing my research to kind of get in the right headspace, and it's really interesting. I really enjoy that musical.
I think it's going to be really cool, especially, like, for college kids. What do you think about that?
I definitely agree. I think it'll definitely, since the target audience basically is people my age and college kids and maybe a little younger, I think it's definitely going to draw in a lot of attention from maybe people who you wouldn't normally see going to Broadway shows and kind of creating buzz among a younger audience, which definitely is good for Broadway.
Yeah, totally. Well, thanks so much, Kylie.
Thank you for having me.
Now repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the band.
I pledge allegiance to the band.
And I promise to give Mr. Sheebly full command.
Tell us a little bit about what you talked about in class today.
All right. Hi, Athenians. I am one of Professor Humphrey's students at Texas Christian University. Today, I'm going to enlighten you on the relationship between religious controversy and musical success. For the sake of this segment, controversy is expressed anger by a religious group. Success is a combination of how long a show ran, how many times it has been revived, how often it has been produced, and how often it recoups its investment. In the leadoff spot, we have Jesus Christ Superstar. It opened in 1971 after originating as a concept record. It was directed by Tom O'Horgan, who you might know from Hair. As for the controversy, the American Jewish Committee and the Anti-Defamation League spoke out against Jesus Christ Superstar because they saw it as the revitalization of the medieval Passion Play. Passion plays were shows during the Middle Ages that depicted the crucifixion and would usually spark anti-Semitism. As for Christians, they were also displeased and protested the show. Why? Number one, Jesus was depicted as a rock star. Some people thought Jesus shouldn't be portrayed at all, let alone in the world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Two, Judas was humanized. According to Christian belief, Judas is possessed by the devil to betray Jesus, and by humanizing Judas in the show, the devil is humanized. Three, it can be interpreted that Jesus might have a relationship with Mary Magdalene. And four, O'Horgan decided to make King Herod a cross-dressing character in the show. And quick disclaimer, not because that's bad in any way, more Andrew Lloyd Webber thought that was ridiculous and didn't know why that had to be in the show, but thought, well, O'Horgan, he did Hair, he does an awesome job, let's be successful. So, was it successful? It launched the Broadway careers of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. It had a 711 performance initial run and had two revivals. The first ran for 161 performances and the second for 116. Many theaters produce it around Easter every year, and it was put to film in 1972. This past Easter, there was even an NBC live version that had 9.4 million viewers, which was the most for a televised musical on NBC in the recent era. Moving on for a second, in the second spot, we have Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Just a little background, Joseph began as a 25-minute long children's play that Rice and Webber wrote for a friend who worked at St. Paul's Junior School in London. A popular music critic happened to be in the audience because his son attended the school. So, after watching the show, he suggested that the two men make a full-length musical out of it. This is prior to Jesus Christ Superstar appearing on Broadway, so this is in the early to mid-60s. Was it controversial? Not at all. It doesn't focus on God very much. It talks about the story of Joseph as pertained in Genesis, so whether you view that as a myth or as factual reality, it still holds up as a story. So it drew audiences in, not only who were Jewish or Christian, but people who just wanted to see a fun, exciting show about a story of perseverance. And it was quite successful. It had a 747 performance initial run, and the 1993 revival had 231 performances. It was considered one of the cheapest shows to produce on Broadway, so running for not as long of a length of time, but for a length of time of over a year, it could recoup its investment significantly. And finally, we have The Book of Mormon, which came out in 2011. It was written by Trey Parker and Matt Stone from South Park, along with Robert Lopez from Avenue Q. Surprisingly, it was not as controversial as expected, because the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints decided to embrace the musical as a talking point about what they believe, saying, all right, you've heard this crazy show that embellishes a lot of things. Now, let's tell you what we truly believe, and use it as a way to reach out to potential converts. They even took out three full-page ads in the playbill that say things like, you've read the book, or you've seen the musical, now read the book, or the book is always better, things like that. It has been far more successful than either two of the previous shows. It made Trey Parker and Matt Stone famous beyond movies and television. It gave them enough money to open up their own production studio to protect their creative interests. Robert Lopez then transferred from Broadway and doing children's television on The Wonder Pets to major blockbusters. He was on Frozen. Here he did the soundtrack and the score for Frozen and Coco with his wife, both of which won Oscars. He won Grammys for Frozen and The Book of Mormon. He's actually a two-time EGOT winner. His Emmy's coming from The Wonder Pets, his Tony's coming from Avenue Q, and The Book of Mormon. The show has run for over 3,000 performances. It has grossed over $575 million as of this October, and there is a plan to create a feature film in the future. A feature film would be in the future. So, does controversy translate to success? Not particularly. Controversy can raise something and bring it up to light. It's the old saying of any publicity is good publicity, where if someone says things are true, or starts talking about something, then you're going to start thinking about it more. Maybe you're going to decide whether or not you need to see it. So, Jesus Christ Superstar was successful because of the controversy. However, it wasn't able to maintain its run over a long period of time because it impacted its target audience. It's mainly focused on a Christian audience, and when a Christian audience is offended by it, then less people of that greater audience might approach the show or be considering spending their money on going to the theater. In the same way, Joseph was more successful because it applies to a greater audience in the Judeo-Christian perspective. And then the Book of Mormon appeals to people not only of a religious background, but also people who might be fans of South Park and have never seen a Broadway show before. So it broadens its audience. Granted, there are other factors beyond this that contribute to a musical success, but controversy merely just raises awareness for a musical. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, totally. Well, but before you go, Brent, I do want to ask one question. What was something that you thought was really, really cool that you found out when you were researching for this presentation?
So when Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice wrote Jesus Christ Superstar, there's an interview with them in the New York Times where they were asked some things about the play, or about the musical, so what they liked, what they didn't like, things like that. But there's one question where they were asked, will you ever be millionaires? And Tim Rice goes, absolutely, we're going to be successful, we're going to be great. And Andrew Lloyd Webber goes, there's no way, how can anyone make over $1 million in musical theater?
I mean, if you're an actor, that is totally true. Awesome. Well, good job, Brent.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
How do they expect us to write a book report of inequality in just 2 days? How can they conspire to make life so miserable and so effectively?
Okay, so next up we have Chloe, and she is going to teach us everything that we ever wanted to know about feminism in Chicago. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Awesome.
Okay, so today I'll be discussing, like she said, feminism in the show Chicago. So the main idea that I'll be proving is that Chicago is reflective of the feminist movements of the 1970s. So this is the original run we're talking about. So to do that, first I'll give you a little background information on feminism in the 70s. Then I will discuss feminist roots of Chicago. And finally, I will give examples of feminism of Chicago. So first we'll talk about feminism in the 70s. So the 1970s were a decade of profound shifts in the terrain of sexual and gender politics in the United States. Many women saw the era as an opportunity for change. The lack of complex representation of their lives, struggles, and triumphs in the mainstream culture and in social justice movements prompted an explosion of profound cultural production in poetry, plays, novels, and music. So now that we've discussed feminism in the 70s a little bit, let's move on to feminism in Broadway, more specifically in Chicago. So as I mentioned before, Chicago has feminist roots, both through the writer of the play and through Bob Fosse. So Chicago originated as a play written by Maureen Dallas Watkins. Watkins was hired by a local newspaper to write about the city's crimes from a woman's angle. Her 8-month stint as a sob sister, or woman journalist, who wrote about female criminals and were sympathetic to their crimes, inspired her to write Chicago. The paper noted that Watkins was a sobless sister that would deal with the facts without tears. Watkins described Chicago... Watkins based Chicago on the crime cases that she witnessed and wrote about for the paper. So Chicago was all based on the true stories. In one story, Watkins described the defendant as a woman whose pursuit of wine, men, and jazz music was interrupted by her glibness with the trigger finger. The character Roxy was based off of a woman that Watkins encountered when working for the paper. This murderess was one Miss Balua, a nun of Chicago, who confessed to killing her lover, Harry Calsted. She was pronounced not guilty by a jury, swayed by her innocent persona and man-taming eyes. Watkins saw right through this murderess's ploy instead of feeling sympathetic like her other female journalists of the time, and decided to write a play to poke fun at the belittling and underestimating views of women of the time. So now on to Fosse. Chicago was Fosse's love-hate letter to Broadway Razzle Dazzle. Despite the revulsion he feels towards the world of hustle and razzle dazzle, it was the only world he knows, and he cannot help but to make it as seductive as possible. He celebrates the magic of theater even while exposing its heartlessness. Chicago for Fosse was a way to rebel against the razzle dazzle of the show business while still participating in it. So now I will discuss some examples of how Chicago was reflective of the feminist movements during the 70s. So, in the 20s, a female murderer must have either been explained away as a monster unable to behave like a proper woman, or she must be a cliche of feminine weakness who could only kill if she herself were victimized. Roxy and Velma, on trial for their lives, mimic respectable ladies in order to be acquitted for their crimes, and yet they publicize a more risque image of themselves for their media audience. This satirizes the concept of femininity by revealing the true nature of these murderesses. As aspiring vaudeville stars, they're more interested on manipulating and captivating their audiences than fully considering the repercussions of their crimes. In fact, when Roxy is officially freed of her charges, she is more focused on the fact that she has lost the media's attention than that she is now a free woman. Chicago reminds us that to assume all female murderers were themselves victims, regardless of circumstance, is ultimately reductive. In a review in Variety magazine of the show's opening night, a critic said that Bob Fosse's choreographic staging and elaborate physical production are the outstanding elements in Chicago. A number in the second act, Razzle Dazzle, might be more appropriate title for the show. The critic believes that the story and characters, perhaps not too unrepresentative of Chicago of the Prohibition era, are vulgar and unattractive, so there's little reason for the audience to care about him. Fosse has something dynamic going on stage every second, however. The critics didn't think that the show would be a success because they believed that it was purely service-level entertainment. The critic was spot on when saying that even discounting the first night hysteria, Chicago seems likely to entertain a reasonable quota of New York showgoers, including visitors, particularly during such a dearth of good new musicals. The show may lack the sort of broad appeal required for mass popularity, however, so the show probably won't reach marathon length. The original run of Chicago only lasted about 2 years, and I believe this overall failure to run long-term was because of the feminist movements of the 70s. While it was entertaining for a while, its overall disrespectful portrayal of women was bound to fail without some changes. So, that's it.
Awesome. Well, Chloe, tell me for a second, why did you decide to do this topic for this presentation?
So Chicago is actually my favorite musical, and I was interested because I didn't know that it had an original run and that the one that's currently on Broadway was a revival. And so I wanted to dig deeper into the changes that occurred between the revival and the original run and why they were what they were.
Awesome. And then that led you to the feminism of the 70s.
Yes.
That's awesome. Well, thanks, Chloe.
Of course.
What do you do with the BA in English? What is my life going to be? 4 years of college and plenty of knowledge have earned me this useless degree. I can't pay the bills yet, 'cause I have no skills yet. The world is a big scary place.
Okay, Mary Elizabeth, you talked about absurdism via Urinetown, right?
Yes.
Awesome. So take it away.
Okay, so the musical Urinetown poses three questions about the meaning of life through the use of absurdism in order to point out societal flaws. So absurdism, to start off, can be a movement or a style, but overall it's devoid of a purpose. When man is cut off from his religious, metaphysical, and transcendental roots, overall man is lost, and all actions become senseless, absurd, and useless. So the first question that it poses is man's quest for good meaningless. We really see this through the character Bobby Strong, who's fighting for the poor, and although he's fighting for something good, he ends up going to Urinetown and dying. And when the town overall wins, they shortly realize that their way of life, as they hoped, without paying to use the restroom, really caused their demise, and they all die in the end anyways. So Robert Malthus had a really big impact on this through his belief that man is capable of overproducing too if left unchecked. So he believed that through family size regulations that we could bring population to a reasonable size, and that poverty and famine, if we didn't do this, were going to be natural outcomes of population growth. Through the song I See a River in Urinetown, we can see this question really expressed, that water disappeared, wasn't long before the water disappeared altogether. Everybody died anyways because they were not able to sustain their lives with the water consumption they were going off of. And at the end of the song, you hear them scream, "Hail Malthus," which is a direct reference to Malthus and his overpopulation belief that their life would be unsustainable if they didn't change it. And then the second question, is everyone corrupt and acting in self-interest? We can look at this through both classes, You're in Good Company and Bobby Strong. Was You're in Good Company really just trying to be greedy and take all the money for themselves, or were they really trying to help this 20-year drought that was going on? And then Bobby Strong, was he just trying to get out of revenge for his father, who was taken to Urinetown, or was he really trying to help the goodwill of the community and help them make their lives better and not have to pay to pee? And this question results back to absurdism, because there's really no objective morality. It's just people's perceptions. And we see this through politics. Epic theater specifically, the purpose of epic theater is to force people, the audience, to think introspectively about the particular movements occurring on stage. And specifically big businesses, the Microsoft versus United States trial was going on during this time, and protest for the environmental movement were going on during the writing, so they really wanted to help the earth become a better place to live. And then class dynamics, rich people becoming more rich and poor people having to keep up giving their money. And then through the song Urinetown, we see this specifically, that people can't pee for free, masses are oppressed, rich folks get the good life and poor folks get the woe. The monopolies are causing the poor people to pay to use the restroom at exorbitant prices and controlling everyone. And there are more poor people in the world, and they are underspoken for, and the rich continue to get the money and suppress the lower class. Then the last question, arrogance or goodwill, so the lower class is really fighting for the freedom from the monopoly and having to pee for free. And they're really trying to fight for their inborn right to relieve themselves and to save money so that they can improve their lives. But they were being arrogant in that they were not thinking about factors such as hydraulics, the way the water moves through the pipes and how it's engineered, and the drought, the water consumption that needed to be at a minimum. And overall, they were fighting for the goodwill of the citizens, but they're arrogant in doing so and forgot what the problem was really about, the water, and this hurt them more than helped them, relating back to absurdism. And then climate change during this time was a big factor. It just started to come about, and Urinetown was in a 20-year drought, and similarly, California was in a moderate to severe drought, and this really showed that this could happen to the United States if we don't put an implication to stop it. And presidential candidates at the time were debating about the importance of keeping the earth the way it is and due to the environmentalism movement. And then, why did I listen to that man, the lyric? Why did I listen to my heart? I heard it call and it made this revolution start. So after the poor win their revolution, they realized that the fee had a purpose and was helping them survive. But they did not see that they were harming the environment and themselves in the process until it was too late, showing that their strive for goodwill really wasn't that good. And the answers to these questions aren't really answered through the musical, which makes it more absurd, and it's left up to the audience to decide for themselves, really relating it back to epic theater, because they want the audience to get thinking and talking about the social issues by presenting it in an appealing way.
Awesome. So tell me, have you ever seen Urinetown?
I have. My brother actually performed as Officer Lockstock in it, so he really exposed me to a lot of the music on the way to school, so I have, like, all the lyrics memorized, but
of course. And what made you want to explore Urinetown within the confines of absurdism?
I always, like, when I first saw the show, I didn't really look at it in, like, a way as to, like, think about what it was really trying to say. Mm-hmm. And so since I did know the musical so well and was interested about it because my brother always related it back to his life, I was like, oh, I'll go and research it so I could, like, come closer to him and just, like, know for my own public opinion.
That's awesome. Well, I'm so glad that you did this presentation then.
Thank you.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be...
Okay, so now we're going to hear from Alex, and he's going to tell us about lighting in theater. So, Alex, take it away.
Well, the evolution of theater lighting in the two centuries since the invention of the carbon arc lamp has been primarily driven by a desire for efficiency, namely in cost and in money. So in the 1800s, the arrival of carbon arc lamps using two carbon electrodes and a voltaic arc between them revolutionized theater lighting by allowing for more direct focused light. It's still used nowadays in high-intensity discharge headlights and in follow spots. However, the original arc lamps were very, very energy efficient. They took a very high voltage to get the voltaic arc going, and they had a relatively short lifespan, as well as producing horrible amounts of UV light, which damaged the eyes of performers. However, in around 1821, Augustin Jean Fresnel invented the Fresnel lamp and the Fresnel lens, designed to be used in lighthouses but adopted in theater. The Fresnel lens, a plano-convex lens with the steps cut away from the convex side, as in most step lenses, allows for a much smaller lens and a much greater diffusion of light. And they're relatively efficient, and they have a much longer lifespan than carbon arc lamps. However, much, much more recently, centuries ahead, LEDs came into existence, incredibly efficient, although a little expensive to install. Many of them have over 100,000 hours of lifespan and take one-tenth the energy requirement of a comparable incandescent bulb, making them a vastly superior option for lighting in theater. Also, they don't require expensive gels or gobos, and the little amount of heat required means you can print them on much cheaper materials and don't have to worry about them melting or breaking.
Awesome. Well, Alex, tell me a little bit about, did you have experience with lighting in theater before this presentation?
Well, I'm from a little school in Louisiana, and back in August 2016, the whole state flooded. So all of our lighting equipment went under, and I read a few manuals to try to fix some of it. And because I read the manuals, people assumed I could do it, and I became light guy.
Awesome. So when I assigned this project for this class, you immediately knew that you wanted to talk about lighting?
To be honest, I wanted to do a juggling speech, but there's not as much juggling as on Broadway as I'd really hope.
That is true. Well, I was very impressed with your presentation, so thanks so much.
Thank you.
For the blood in the water, read your Thomas Hobbes. Only spineless snobs will quarrel with the morally dubious jobs. Yes, blood in the water, your scruples are a flawless.
So next we have Delaney, and she talked to us about Fanny Bryce. So Delaney, tell us a little bit about your research.
Hi, thank you for having me. So I talked about Fanny Bryce, and I really researched into a few different characteristics that make Fanny Bryce who she is. And so I found a lot on the dialect that she used, the physical humor in her performances, as well as her brassy characteristics that really make her stand out and make her unique as a performer. And so regarding the dialect, we know that Fanny Bryce is known for using a Yiddish dialect, and it's super interesting because Fanny grew up daughter of Jewish immigrants in the Lower East Side of New York City, and she lived in the ghettos of New York City where there is a big blend of different nationalities, people of different backgrounds with very strong dialects. They are probably straight from those countries that their dialect sounds like. And so Fanny Bryce actually dropped out of school after eighth grade, and she spent a lot of time honing her craft, so she had time to pick up on these different dialects. And although Fanny herself did not speak with the Yiddish dialect, she played into that because Jewishness was such a hot topic in the early 1900s. And so she used it first in her show, The College Girls by Max Spiegel, and she got roaring laughter when she used it. So she just kind of continued that and made it a sort of trademark. We also see Fanny Bryce utilizing this physical humor. And so with the physical humor, Fanny started on the vaudeville circuit, like doing an act on one of those stages. And a vaudeville performer has to really stand out and be very unique. So along with her dialect that she used, she also uses physical humor, and where she used her body to be funny, and she also used a lot of facials. She's really wide eyes, or she'd use a smirk, or just these really funny little quips that made her unique and made people laugh. And so it, in that same show, actually, when she first used her Yiddish dialect, The College Girls, Fanny wore a starched white sailor suit that was really uncomfortable and very hard to move around in. And the audience saw her trying to get comfortable and shifting it around, and they thought that she was doing this to be funny. And so Fanny took cues from this, and she overplayed it. And so we see this continue on really throughout the rest of her humor and those acts. It's also important to note that Fanny using this sort of physical humor versus her body just for a show or something to look at was very different than women at the time. In the early 1900s, women were definitely something to be looked at. They were stereotyped that they had to be very pretty and very graceful, and shows like The Follies emphasized this standard American beauty, and they had a very specific image about what a woman should look like. And Fanny being on stage, she didn't quite fit that mold, but people were very drawn to her and very attracted to her. And part of that as well would definitely be this brassy characteristic that she carried. Merriam-Webster defines brassy as shamelessly bold. And I think for Fanny to really fully encompass this persona, this Fanny Bryce persona that she has, that she's so famous for today, she definitely had that shamelessly bold characteristic. She wasn't afraid to be funny, and she used her body again for humorous aspects. Fanny also was not a good dancer. She lost a lot of roles in the choruses because she couldn't dance as well as other people. And so by Fanny using her body in a different way also made her different. This brassy characteristic is something that we typically associate more with women in comedy today. We see this with characters such as Melissa McCarthy and her humor in Bridesmaids, which is the funniest movie. If you guys haven't seen it, you should. And Melissa McCarthy plays this kind of gross character. She's definitely not a girly girl. She's just kind of gritty, and she's fully herself. And I think a lot of women take cues from Fanny Bryce and their work. Melissa McCarthy also utilized that body humor, that physical humor as well. And so I think Fanny Bryce is the best role model for women. It was so fun researching her because she has all of these traits that definitely make her stand out and make her into the performer that she is and she's famous for today.
Awesome. So tell me, Delaney, did you have any stories that you came across when you were researching that you were like, I did not know this at all, and this is really exciting, maybe about somebody like Maya Rudolph or Lucille Ball, other people that you highlighted in your presentation?
Yeah, of course. So with Maya Rudolph, she comes from mixed background. Her mother was African-American, and her father was Eastern European. And so Maya Rudolph is able to have this sort of ambiguous ethnicity and carry on a lot of different roles. And so she utilized Fanny Bryce's, she took cues from her with the dialects. And so she was able to portray a Hispanic character. She's able to portray Beyonce and Saturday Night Live, all of these different characters just by changing her voice. And she's really funny through doing all of those things and having a lot of versatility to her act.
Yeah, and that totally comes from Fanny Bryce, and you did such a great job today in showing us that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so now we're going to hear from Anna, and she is going to tell us about one of my favorite shows, The Chorus Line. So what did you talk about today?
So in my presentation, I talked a lot about basically the question that Zach asks in A Chorus Line when he asks them, if today were the day you had to stop dancing, how would you feel? And basically trying to bridge the gap between how dancers feel about this question and how everybody else can also relate to the same story, even if you're not a dancer. So I think it's something really important to think about all the issues that A Chorus Line tackles, from ageism to casting discrimination to difficulties with injury and lack of work, and basically just to try and imagine what these lives of dancers were really like, since A Chorus Line is based on the lives of real dancers. So to begin, I started with talking about the inspiration that came before A Chorus Line was created. So it was originally called the Dancer Project, and it basically stemmed from a series of interview tapings and workshops by the director and choreographer Michael Bennett. He recruited a lot of dancers from a lot of his past shows and gathered them all together to tell stories about their lives in hopes that there might be a common thread that would become a show eventually. Even in these early stages, many of the cast members viewed it as an opportunity for a job, which is kind of an interesting way that they might relate to their characters that they would eventually go on to portray, because they understood what it was like to want to tell a good story, to want to be a part of this job opportunity. Something interesting is the inspiration that Michael Bennett took from his mentor, Jerome Robbins, who worked on West Side Story. So basically, Jerome Robbins obviously separated the Jets and Sharks during rehearsal. And actually, it was noted that Michael Bennett did sort of a similar thing to try and keep this competition feeling between the cast, which was very interesting. He also asked a lot of them the same exact questions that Zach would ask in the show, which created a lot of these quotes that would later become characters and become songs in the story. They then moved on to having the show workshopped at the Public Theater. So it was downtown, is a very secretive project, and it was funded by producer Joseph Papp. There were two workshops, one that was 5 weeks long and the other was 15 weeks long. After going to Broadway, some changes were even made further on from that. Even though we all know that A Chorus Line was based on the lives of real dancers, I was really interested in just how close to reality this actually came and exactly what issues they tackled. So the first issue that I talked about was the lack of work. There were only 54 shows total in the season before A Chorus Line in 1973 to 1974, which was actually a new low for Broadway. So a lot of these dancers were actually struggling to find work. And a common misconception about A Chorus Line is that it's about new dancers and new actors trying to find work, but really the story is about these seasoned professionals who have been on Broadway and are still struggling to find work, which is a big issue that A Chorus Line tackles. They also tackle the idea of ageism in theater and dance. This is really prevalent in the show when Zach asks for their ages and some of them have hesitations. I actually did some research according to the Census Bureau, which talked about basically employment and the ages of people employed in choreography and dance. So something that's really important for dancers is to kind of cultivate their talent so that they can keep going even after their bodies might not be able to sustain the type of dance that they're doing now. But this can be a real struggle because everyone gets into dancing because it's what they love to do. So it can be really hard to try and find something else, which is what a lot of the characters talk about in A Chorus Line. A Chorus Line also takes an active stance on the overly exaggerated focus on stardom in America. Some ways it did this was by paying everyone equally $100 per week and by dialogue in the show discussing the dreams of characters becoming stars. The focus on similarities rather than standing out in A Chorus Line juxtaposes this obsession with stardom that you see in America with so many shows that need a big star. A Chorus Line had a monumental impact in the theater world, and many believed it saved Broadway. It did this by bringing money to different organizations, like the Schubert Organization, which funds and facilitates creation of new shows. It also helped the rest of Broadway gain attention and encouraged producer investment in future shows, which was super important. One big influencer on Broadway today, Lin-Manuel Miranda, actually got a lot of inspiration from A Chorus Line after doing it in high school. When he began working on Hamilton, it had a lot of the similar workshopping style. It was actually both, they were both at the Public Theater, and Miranda actually talked about in an interview how cool it was to get to honor the original cast of A Chorus Line in their kind of celebration of the 40th anniversary at the Public Theater when they sang What I Did for Love and paid tribute to them, which was really interesting. It's really important to know that A Chorus Line is not just about dancers. It's about just being human beings, and it's about loving something. So I think that my research really helped me to see that A Chorus Line does span the ages, and it does span beyond just dancers, and that it really explained to me why so many people find joy and can resonate with A Chorus Line, even if they aren't dancers.
That's awesome. Oh, I love that that research did that for you. I was really impressed with the graphic that you brought up from the Census Bureau about the ages, the common ages for dancers. When you first saw that graph, what did you think?
It was just incredible to me to think about, you know, you think about all the different professions where having a lot of experience is such a good thing, and it's so hard for me to believe that it just must be so hard when you have so much experience to have something like somebody talks about in the show comparing dancers to athletes and just how everybody's doing it because they love it, and it just shows you that these people know when they're getting into the business, they know that they may not be able to dance forever, but it doesn't keep them from doing it, and it doesn't keep them, it's the whole idea behind the song What I Did for Love. It's the whole idea behind you can't regret what you do for love, and they can't think about what they're going to do when they can't dance anymore. They just got to think about how much they love what they're doing now, which I think is really beautiful and really powerful.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I'm with you, getting to know what to say. I really loved it, cause the day I'm trying to breathe.
Haven't you noticed?